This is BBC Radio 3. Choral Evensong today is at the later than usual time of 6 o'clock when we have a service given in Ripon Cathedral. But now, from the organ loft of the Royal Albert Hall here in London, here's Louise Fryer with the first of today's two proms.
Good afternoon. Two first performances at the proms and a world premiere. That's what the next hour holds as organist Stephen Farr makes his debut at the BBC Proms. He's played the King of Instruments all over the world. He'll be taking his place here in just a moment at the mighty Willis Organ, one of the UK's largest, to play Litany by Jean Alain, then celebrating Liszt's bicentenary with an organ arrangement of the piano prelude Weinen, Klagen, Sorgen, Zagen, based on a theme by Bach, and after a chorale prelude thought to be by Bach himself, going on to give the first ever public performance of The Everlasting Crown by Judith Bingham, especially commissioned for this year's proms. I'll be talking to Stephen Farr about that later on this afternoon. Jean Alain was a contemporary of Messiaen and very much an heir to the French organ tradition. His father was an organist. He'd been taught by Alexandre Guillemot and Louis Vienne. Albert Alain had built a large organ in the family home, and his four children, Jean amongst them, were encouraged to play it. Jean's youngest sister, Marie-Claire, growing up to become an organist with an international career. Although Jean set out on a similar course, his life was tragically cut short, taking part in a reconnaissance mission in June 1940, shortly before France capitulated to the German invaders. Jean was just 29 years old. He was a devout Catholic with a strong belief in prayer. He described it as a blast of wind that sweeps all before it. And the piece we're about to hear, Litany, encapsulates that description. It was composed 2 years before his death, and it's certainly not a private, mumbled invocation. Jean noted rather irreverently in the margin that the music was like a man pushing a wheelbarrow, chased by a policeman and pelted with bricks. 3 weeks after completing the piece, another of Jean's sisters was killed in a mountaineering accident, and he dedicated it to her memory with these words. When Christian souls run out of words to implore the mercy of God, fired by faith, they repeat over and over again the same invocation. It's a powerful piece, and to play it, let's welcome the organist, Stephen Farr.
Thank you.
Litany by Jean-Alain Stephen Farr, the organist, making his debut at the Royal Albert Hall. This is the first of two organ proms this year, both celebrating 200 years since the birth of Franz Liszt. And Stephen's going to do so by giving the first proms performance of Weinen, Klagen, Sorgen, Zagen, Weeping, Lamenting, Sorrows, Fears. It was written before the well-known organ work by Liszt of the same title, a set of free variations on a bass line used by Bach in both the Crucifixus of the B minor Mass and his cantata BWV 12, from which comes the title. Liszt composed the piece in 1859 in the aftermath of the death of his son Daniel. This prelude after Johann Sebastian Bach was composed for piano, but Liszt's contemporary, the great German organist Alexander Winterberger, made an organ transcription of the piece, and this is what Stephen plays next.
Thank you.
Liszt's Prelude after Bach, Weinen, Klagen, Sorgen, Sagen, arranged for organ by Alexander Winterberger and played by Stephen Farr, incorporating a 60-foot stop on the pedals there. Well, to follow a chorale prelude by Bach himself, Erbarm dich mein, O Herrgott, BWV 721, also performed for the first time here at the Proms. And although I say it's by Bach, there's some uncertainty. It's not really like any of his other organ pieces, and it's come down to us only as a copy. There's no sign of an original manuscript. The chorale on which it's based follows the lamenting theme of the works we've heard so far. Here, a miserable sinner begging for God's pity. Have mercy on me, O Lord God.
Thank you.
Stephen Farr with the chorale prelude Erbarm dich mein, O Herrgott, BWV 721, ascribed to J.S. Bach. And after the great array of sounds which Stephen's already unleashed for us this afternoon from the Royal Albert Hall organ, I can tell you that he played that little prelude on two simple flute stops, so something of a sorbet after the sonic feast so far. Now, Stephen, let me just join you for a moment at the console. Two simple flute stops, but here on this organ, you have 150 to choose from for other pieces. How do you make that choice?
Well, the first thing I did was to sit down with a copy of the stop list and a very, very stiff drink. And I suppose to begin to form some sort of a sense of the kind of sonority I was after. So whether it was going to be a kind of flute sound or a reed sonority or a string sound. And to sketch out a rough blueprint along the lines of perhaps we'll try the flutes on the swell here. But of course, once you come to the instrument and you hear it in the building, very often you have to sort of tear that blueprint up and start again.
Now you have a particularly enormous array of stops to choose from. The next piece you're going to play was conceived with this instrument in mind. Is contemporary music very important for you in your repertoire?
Absolutely. I do play a substantial amount of it, not only by Judith, although I play a lot of hers. I think it's essential that we keep playing contemporary music. You know, it's important to keep the repertoire alive, to have a constant sort of influx of fresh ideas and sort of new composers. If we don't play composers' music, they'll stop writing, and that would be a tragedy, I think.
Now, Judith, for her piece that we're about to hear, The Everlasting Crown, doesn't actually specify the stops that she wants, but she gives rather more poetic descriptions of the kinds of sounds she's after, so monkishly or the sound of a fresh, open expanse. How do you then go about putting that into a practical solution?
One or two of those descriptions did conjure up very specific ideas in sound, I mean, as soon as one reads them. So in one of the movements, there's a phrase that the warm air vibrates like a mirage, I think, is the rather poetic phrase. And so it seems to me that instantly here, one would reach for the choir orchestral strings, which kind of have a very gentle sort of shimmer. But a great deal of trial and error and experiment goes into it. And I have to say that in all of that process, I've had a tremendous amount of help from two wonderful colleagues, Tom Bell and Stephen Disley, who's here with me at the console today, who gave up hours of their time to sit in the hall and just sort of check balances. So I would say that anything that works, I would give them the credit. Anything that doesn't quite come off, I take the blame.
That's very noble of you. But does that mean that if Judith's piece was performed on a different instrument, it would take on a different complexion?
It would take on a different complexion. I mean, that's inevitably the case with any piece when you transfer from instrument to instrument. But I mean, I think one of the kind of great things for me about Judith's writing for the instrument is that the music per se is strong enough to withstand any kind of variety of sonic treatment, if you like. There are composers whose music is so intimately tied to the idea of particular sound or even particular instruments that, especially if they're not such good composers, that when you transfer them to other environments, it really doesn't work so well. But this piece, I think, well, I'm playing it probably about a dozen times in the next 6 months on very different instruments, and I think all of them will have something to bring to it.
Well, we're about to hear you perform the world premiere. I'll let you reseat yourself as you wish. Well, I just tell you a little bit more about the piece. It's called The Everlasting Crown, which seems very much a fitting title for a work written for the King of Instruments, and it explores the meaning of monarchy. It's a seven-movement suite, commissioned in memory of Edward Griffiths by his father, and the music conjures up a lavish but imaginary ceremonial crown decorated with seven fabulous gemstones of legend. Each movement takes one of these jewels to encode one of the qualities of royalty. Judith says it's both good and bad. So divinity, loneliness, overweening ambition, personal pain, piety, conquest, and spectacle. And that range will certainly give us plenty of opportunities to hear this vast organ here in the Royal Albert Hall in all its many different colours. So Stephen Farr will give the world premiere performance of The Everlasting Crown by Judith Bingham.
Thank you.
Judith Bingham's The Everlasting Crown, that world premiere performance given by the organist Stephen Farr. And the jewels in the crown, Atahualpa's emerald, the pearl called La Pellegrina, the Orloff diamond, the Russian spinel, King Edward's sapphire, the Timur ruby, and the Kohinoor, the last representing spectacle. And Stephen, gesturing towards Judith Bingham, who's here in the hall to witness that performance, the piece commissioned in memory of Edward Griffiths. Judith herself, a former member of the BBC Singers, these days a full-time composer, and very much trying to return the focus back to Stephen, who's taking a bow from the organ gallery. Judith has won no fewer than 4 British Composer Awards. Well, Stephen Farr is making his debut here today at the Proms. He was saying earlier that today's concert represents the culmination of a journey which began when, as a young child, he was brought to a hymn-singing festival at the Royal Albert Hall. And that's what inspired him to take up this instrument. And he's back to give us an encore.
I'm playing it in a reconstruction by the German scholar and organist Helga Schauter. And just 2 things to mention about it. The first thing is that it's almost a kind of fantasia on the note B, which sounds absolutely continuously through the piece, whether frankly as a pedal note or as a kind of ostinato figure, or concealed in some really wonderful harmony. And the second thing to say is that as Litany was prefaced by some remarks by Alain, this piece has at its close a similar set of remarks by Alain, and I have just enough French left from my school days to translate. Alain's phrase at the end of the piece goes as follows: they worked for a long time without respite and without hope. Their hands became rough. Gradually, little by little, they entered into the great rhythm of life. Alain's deuxième prélude profane.
Bringing the poem full circle, that was the Deuxième Prélude Profond by Jean Alain. That reconstruction, an encore for Stephen Farr, formerly an organ scholar at Clare College, Cambridge. He started when the senior organ scholar was Richard Egar, and I was there myself, my room in the last year next door to the chapel, so I was often aware of Richard and Stephen's late night and early morning practice sessions. Stephen, as I say, making his debut here at the BBC Proms. Well, talking of volume, the platform below the organ console is crammed full of music stands, four harps, five sets of timpani, and all manner of percussion, awaiting this evening's extravaganza, the Gothic Symphony by Havergal Brian. That will include 600 adult singers, 200 children, and 200 instrumental players. I'll leave you to do the maths. The prom begins at 7 o'clock. But for now, that's all from the Royal Albert Hall, and over to Jill Anderson.
Thank you very much. That was Louise Fryer at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, I should say that at 5:15, which is in about 7 minutes' time, we'll be going over to the Royal College of Music to join Sarah Walker, and she'll be giving an introduction to Havergal Brian's Gothic Symphony. And at 6 o'clock, we've choral evensong from Ripon Cathedral. So before we hear about Havergal Brian, here's some music by William Byrd, an arrangement for brass by Mark Kroll. This is The Bells.
Thank you.
Canadian Brass playing Birds the Bells, an arrangement by Mark Kroll. And here they are again playing La Volta from Birds the Fitzwilliam Suite. Canadian Brass playing La Volta by William Byrd. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now 5:15, and on this first prom choral Sunday, we go live to the Royal College of Music in London, where we join Sarah Walker.
Good evening from the Royal College of Music. Tonight at the proms, we've a rare opportunity to hear Havergal O'Brien's Gothic Symphony. It's going to be played live for us at the Royal Albert Hall by a whole host of ensembles centering around the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. Now, having worked with them before, I know that this orchestra is always up for a challenge. And with the Gothic Symphony, they've opted to perform the world's longest symphony. It has mythical status among scholars, musicians, and listeners. And this chance to really experience it and not just know it by reputation is really not to be missed. The tickets have been flying out of the box office. So with the help of my three contributors here this evening and some CD extracts, I want to lift the veil on the Gothic Symphony. With me are Nick Whiting, Associate Leader of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Ian Fisher, the orchestra's third horn, and Adrian Partington, Chorus Master. We'll be chatting a bit later about your individual input into the performance, but I want to just give a clear impression right now about what sort of a beast we're dealing with. Adrian is in charge of the massive choral forces. We've four mixed choirs, children's choir, and a quartet of soloists. And Nick and Ian are part of an enormous orchestra, each section about three times as big as usual, with lots of unusual additions such as contrabass clarinet, contrabassoons, contrabass trombone. There's an oboe d'amore, there's a bass oboe, there's organ. There's lots of percussion, including a thunder machine, and four offstage brass bands. So here is a little sample of what's in store for us. So there we have a climactic passage from part two of the work, voices and orchestra making an incredible noise, and you can imagine what that's going to sound like over in the Royal Albert Hall. Well, let's rewind to the start now and get to know the movements one by one. And to put things in context, we're dealing with a work of two main parts, and each one has three movements. The first part is for orchestra only, and the second part, that's where all the voices, all the extra instruments come in. And that is the really heavyweight part of the symphony. It's much longer than the first. In fact, when the symphonies start, you might think we're in for something fairly conventional. The first movement is based on two contrasting themes, just like a classical symphony. Here's the start of the first movement, and you'll hear the first main theme very soon after the opening. So there we have the opening bars of the Gothic Symphony. What sort of mood is Havergal Brian setting there? Well, I certainly get an impression of great determination there in a rather dark context, courage in adversity. And I think those qualities tie in with some of the information that Brian gives us about the work. The quote from Goethe's Faust, which he includes at the head of the score, "He who strives with all his might, that man we can redeem." In fact, he intended the whole of the first half to reflect the story of Faust, the man who is so curious for knowledge and personal growth that he begins dabbling with forces stronger than he can control. And there are parallels here with the title of the symphony, The Gothic, because Brian thought of the Gothic Age as an age of incredible progress, cultural advancement for mankind. And Faust's personal journey has echoes of the cultural journey of medieval man. So the first movement, in fact, the music as a whole, has a probing feeling. It's always moving forwards. Let's hear the second theme from the first movement now. It's highly contrasted to the first one, which is what we'd expect from a traditional symphony. And Nick is going to play this more gentle theme for us now. Thank you, Nick. Well, that was the second main theme of the Gothic Symphony's first movement. It's much more suave than the first theme. Let's hear how Brian develops this lyrical theme. It's interesting because it starts sounding rather pastoral. And if that reminded you a little of Vaughan Williams, well, see what you make of this violin solo, which comes later, just before the lyrical theme returns to lead the first movement towards its end. There's a little passage marked recit, which leads back to the lyrical theme, and Nick's going to play this for us. And that leads on to the return of the folk-like theme, beautifully coloured and harmonised. Also, listen to the detail in the woodwind writing, such a lot of detail despite the number of instruments playing. And lovely writing for the timps in there too. But we hear a lovely falling phrase going all through the woodwind section. Piccolo, flutes, oboe d'amore, bass oboe, cor anglais, bassoon, clarinets, bass clarinets, and harps and celeste making it all twinkle. So that is the tranquil middle section of the first movement, though the music doesn't stay peaceful. The darkness and anxiety of the opening returns. And listen out for some more fantastic writing for the timps. And of course the organ, which is going to sound. So we'll hear to the end of the movement. The end of the first movement of the Gothic Symphony, and without giving us the slightest break, Havergal Brian moves straight on to the second movement. Now, this has been described as a march, but it's a march with five beats in a bar. It opens with timps and tubas, and their dotted rhythms turn out to be a very important element of this movement. And just a few bars later, the lowest strings play a haunting march melody. It's slightly oriental sounding, and that's also an important ingredient later on. So let's hear those seminal opening bars.